The United States is joined by every other Western power, Australia, for example, which just recently has been denying asylum to fleeing Afghan refugees. It intercepts them illegally on the high seas. In one particularly ugly recent case, which you probably saw, it shipped them off to a tiny little island, the island of Nauru, which alone was willing to accept its obligations under the Universal Declaration. Prime Minister John Howard of Australia just won re-election by forcefully rejecting Article 14 of the Universal Declaration. That was his main plank. That's a crime against humanity that was hugely popular down under. And the reason is simple. These are just rights of human beings, they can easily be set aside. That's quite unlike rights of private tyrannies. They have to be safeguarded and defended by every possible means. An example of that in this morning's newspaper, if you look. It was announced that this tiny island, Nauru, is being sanctioned or threatened with sanctions because of money laundering, which is harmful to the international financial system. Presume the charges are correct. But notice that Australia faces no charges for violating Article 14 of the Universal Declaration by sending starving refugees off to Nauru, which also receives no benefits from having observed the Universal Declaration. So Afghans who are fleeing from one of the most miserable corners of the world, they can be taken in by Pakistan or Iran, as they have been in the millions, but they can expect nothing from the rich and the powerful, who are incidentally currently destroying what's left of their country. And this is true no matter what the Universal Declaration happens to say. The provisions of the Universal Declaration are not very well known in the United States, but some of them are familiar. Undoubtedly, the most famous is Article 13, technically Section 2 of Article 13, which states that everyone has the right to leave any country, including his own. That principle was invoked with a great deal of passion every year on Human Rights Day, December 10th, with demonstrations and indignant condemnations of the Soviet Union for its refusal to let Soviet Jews leave in direct violation of Article 13. It's true in Boston, too, big demonstrations every year. To be exact, the words that I just quoted were invoked, but not the words that follow. The words that follow are, "and to return to his own country." So everyone has the right to leave any country, including his own, and to return to his country. The significance of the omitted words was spelled out on December 11th, 1948. That's the day after the Universal Declaration was ratified, when the General Assembly unanimously passed Resolution 194, which affirms the right of Palestinians to return to their homes or receive condemnation. It's reaffirmed regularly since. Year after year, the demonstrations, which were often led by distinguished law professors famous for upholding civil rights, omitted the unwelcome phrase, quite confident, correctly, that the press and intellectuals would look the other way, as they invariably did. It obviously simply wouldn't do to bring to light the glaringly obvious fact that those who were exhorting the Soviet tyranny to observe Article 13 to much acclaim were in fact its most dedicated opponents. The fact is transparent, so transparent that it better not be mentioned, and it was never mentioned. Check and see. It's only fair to add that the cynicism about this has indeed been overcome. At the December 1993 session of the United Nations, the Clinton administration changed official U.S. policy. It joined Israel in opposing UN 194, which was then reaffirmed by a vote of 127-2. And as is the norm in such cases, there was no report or no comment. But at least the inconsistency is now behind us. The first half of Article 13 has lost its relevance with the disappearance of the Soviet Union, and Washington now officially rejects the second half, so no inconsistency any longer. That, too, has human consequences, which are very evident today. I don't have to talk about it. Other rights that fall within the civil and political regime are formulated in Articles 17 and 19 and 21. They guarantee the right to receive and impart information and ideas through any media, and to take part in genuine elections that ensure that the will of the people will be the basis of the authority of government. It's long been recognized that state power is not the only form of interference with the fundamental right to receive and impart information and ideas. And in the industrial democracies, it's not the most important one by a long shot. Those are matters that have been quite prominently discussed by John Dewey and George Orwell, to mention only two examples. In 1946, there was a prestigious commission, the Hutchins Commission on Freedom of the Press, established. It warned that private agencies controlling the great mass media constitute a fundamental threat to freedom of the press, with their ability to impose an environment of vested beliefs and bias as a commercial enterprise under the influence of advertisers and owners. The European Commission of Human Rights has endorsed that principle and recognized excessive concentration of the press as an infringement of the rights guaranteed by Article 19, calling on all states to prevent these abuses, a position that's also been endorsed by Human Rights Watch and other human rights organizations. Well, the significance of that is pretty clear without bothering with any comment for elections as well. The enormous importance of maintaining monopoly power over expression was demonstrated when UNESCO, about 20 years ago, tried to democratize the media by initiating what was called a new international information order. It was based on the idea that the South should be able to participate in the international media, breaking the Western monopoly. The United States government and the media bitterly condemned UNESCO. There was a very impressive flood of deceit and lies, uncorrectable, reiterated without change after refutation, which was very rarely permitted expression. This is quite a record, actually. It was summed up by an academic historian of the U.S. UNESCO relations, William Preston. Now, he writes that the stunning irony of this achievement was that the United States, having proved that the free market in ideas did not exist, attacked UNESCO for planning to destroy it, and in fact proceeded virtually to destroy UNESCO. Now, there's a detailed review of media and government deceit published by University of Minnesota Press, also been ignored. That history provides a very revealing measure of the attitudes toward the basic principles of freedom and democracy, and it would be of great value to those who are concerned with the nature of free expression and how it's defended and upheld in a free society. I presume that's why it's not reviewed and unknown. And there are, again, recent examples. NATO bombed and destroyed Serbian TV for a simple reason. It refused to accept a demand that it run 6 hours of NATO propaganda every day. So therefore it was bombed and destroyed, and that's not considered a crime. Just recently, Al Jazeera, the one independent news channel in the Arab world, which has been bitterly attacked by the Arab countries because it exposes their crimes all the time. Just recently it was called on by the U.S. government, by Colin Powell, to stop preventing what the U.S. regards as unacceptable propaganda, that is, things that don't fall within the right framework. The emir of Qatar happened to be in Washington at the time, and he called a press conference in which he informed the press that Qatar was going to defend the freedom of the press against the United States and not rein in Al Jazeera, which is based there. That passed without report except in the Wall Street Journal, which had a good report on it. Same thing happened in Pakistan. I just happened to be there a couple days ago. The Pakistani press reported that the U.S. ambassador, Wendy Chamberlain, had essentially ordered the Pakistani government to prevent the Taliban embassy — they had an embassy there — to prevent them from holding news conferences. on the grounds that the ambassador at the news conferences was telling lies, as she put it. I'm sure she's right. And Pakistan, of course, agreed. The principle is that only our lies should be permitted expression in the free market of ideas. That, too, passes without any comment. The records of Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International provide ample and compelling evidence that what I've just said barely scratches the surface with regard to civil and political rights. Regrettably, the human rights organizations generally adhere to Western practice in largely ignoring the other provisions of the Universal Declaration. But these few examples should suffice to make it clear that while Asian relativism is very real and completely disgraceful, it by no means stands alone, and also to reveal that the self-adulation of Western intellectuals is very far from justified on this score and others. There are more subtle and far-reaching illustrations of the conflict between prevailing doctrines and the principles of the Universal Declaration. I don't think any are more important than the process called globalization, in fact, specific form of international integration that should be understood, I think, as a direct assault against democracy and freedom, against both the civil and political and the socioeconomic provisions of the Universal Declaration. That's a large topic, but for some other time. The hopeful element in all of this is that it can all be changed, and pretty easily, without incurring any great personal cost in very free societies like ours. These are not matters of fate. They're not matters of mysterious historical laws. They're just ordinary will and choice. Thanks. Why don't you get started? I think people can hear. You got a loud voice.
two-part question. I'll try to keep it quick. First part is, how do you argue, or do you try to bother with people of the mainstream view that might does equal rights, such as my kind of liberal brother-in-law saying in response to the fact that we bombed Al Jazeera, but do you know what kind of cruel things they said on Al Jazeera? So he sort of, and many people internalize that. And the second part, just for people who feel sort of dispirited by sort of the enormity of the sort of changes here and the rollback, as it feels, of a lot of things, what kind of hope can you offer?
Well, you know, with regard to arguing against people who say that might is right, you shouldn't argue against them. They're correct. You don't argue against the truth. What you do is something quite different. I mean, you ask them, do they really believe in that principle? And I'll bet you, was it your brother or whoever it is? I'm sure he doesn't. You know, if you pursue the question whether he really believes that principle, he'll certainly won't. And then comes the question, well, why do you accept it in this case? But to argue against the truth of it is a mistake, because it, in fact, is true. That's the way the world works, and will work, as long as people let it work that way. As for the rollback, I mean, it's certainly an effort. I mean, in fact, you take it for granted that whenever there's any kind of crisis, those who have power are going to exploit that window of opportunity to, you know, to impose harsh, regressive measures and to follow their natural instincts, in this case, to institute quasi-fascist rules. And, yeah, they'll do it if there's an earthquake, and they would do it to exploit the fear and the anguish that followed the atrocities of September 11th. But, you know, yeah, that you expect. The question is, do you accept it? I don't think it's being all that much accepted. I think the country's a lot more open and resistant than the headlines indicate, so I don't feel really hopeless about that. I think there are plenty of opportunities. In fact, I think there's more openness to discussion of a whole range of issues than there was before September 11th. Certainly true in my experience, and I heard the same from others.
Professor Chomsky, I have listened to you very attentively, and my question would be, from Egyptian Empire to Roman Empire to British Empire and the present American Empire, to an extent that during the British Empire, Thomas Jefferson claimed that should the British Empire fall or collapse, the world will have peace and justice. Could you tell me, or could you tell us that what America is doing today, others have not done that? And could you tell us that with the Chinese Empire far from it, China will know what America is doing? So what is the difference? What is America doing that is different from other empires? Thank you.
Was it then? Nothing much. It's following a very traditional imperial policy. And there are differences. One difference is that unlike the Roman Empire and the Chinese Empire, it's internally free, which means that citizens can do a lot to change it if they decide to. That's a big difference. And in fact, have done a lot. So the ability of the U.S. to use violence is far below what it was, say, 40 years ago. For example, I talked about the bombing of South Vietnam and the attack on South Vietnam in the early 60s. It went on for 4 years without a whisper of protest. I mean, until a couple of years after that, in Boston, a pretty liberal city, you couldn't have public demonstrations against the war because they'd be broken up violently by students. You know, they attacked churches, I mean, break up meetings on the Boston Common. The press would applaud it. It was wonderful. By that time, hundreds of thousands of people had been killed in South Vietnam. You know, there were a couple hundred thousand American troops rampaging there. There's nothing like that's even imaginable today. And it's because of the extent to which the citizens undertook their own responsibilities and put some constraints on the government. Nowhere near enough, but, you know, it's a lot. We shouldn't underestimate it. That's a big difference from other empires. This one can collapse from within, and should. You know.
I'm sure you know the book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. And first, I'd like your comments about the essential accuracy of the thesis. Secondly, does this really mean that he is under some sort of personal risk, as Pinochet was, if it were not for his mental condition, quote, end quote, of not being able to travel outside of the U.S.? What does this imply for anyone other than the president?
Well, if you want my opinion on the accuracy, I'll be happy to tell you, but off the record, just in brief, parts of it I think are very accurate, actually parts that were lifted from other sources, but and some others are too. But, you know, basically the story, I think, is more or less accurate, basically. On the other hand, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to charge Henry Kissinger personally. You know, these are not personal matters. Kissinger's role was not different from a long list of other people. He's kind of like easy to attack. He's that type of person. But his record isn't worse than others. For example, take Moynihan, who I mentioned. Why not attack him? I mean, he describes his own crimes happily, cheerfully. And to go back to the Kennedy administration, I mean, a whole raft of criminals. And it continues. I mean, these are just institutional facts. I don't think that any person in power, with real power, suffers any threat of criminal prosecution, including those who are there right now. I mean, again, let me just repeat that some of this is just entirely uncontroversial. The United States was condemned for international terrorism in one case. By the World Court, and those very same people happen to be implementing policy now. I mean, how can they face any threat if nobody even knows about it or is willing to talk about it? So Kissinger himself is, in my view, pretty insignificant, but in fact, he kind of explained pretty well his own role. He's pretty honest in many ways. He's an expert, and he described the role of the expert as, I wish you could remember the exact words, but the drift was something like this. He said the expert is the person who knows how to articulate the consensus of the powerful. And that's correct. That's what made him an expert. He knew how to articulate the consensus of the powerful. But he didn't have any power. You know, the power, he was representing it and speaking for it. He made decisions, but if he'd made the wrong decisions, he'd be out in his ear. You know? I think it's kind of misleading to focus on an individual that way, even if the charges are accurate, as to a large extent they are.
So you were mentioning earlier that this is an empire that can collapse from within, and I was wondering what, in your opinion, is some steps that we all can take.
mean, you know, take everything I mentioned today, which is just the tip of an iceberg. I mean, that can all be reversed. It doesn't require a revolution. It can be reversed by vote, you know. Of course, to get that far, you have to have education and organization. People have to know about it. I mean, it's all kept secret, you know, for pretty good reasons. It's kept secret because people like your brother, was it, or, you know, brother-in-law, I mean, they find out about it, they're not going to like it, you know. They don't want to be responsible for crimes like that, so it's kept secret. But then that tells you what you can do, prevent it from being secret. That there are easy ways to do that. You can't do it alone, you know, but you can do it in organizations. And that can reach the point where it does impose real constraints on power, constraints powerful enough to eliminate it. It's a very fragile system. They know it. Now, take, say, the last World Trade Organization meeting last month. It was a good reason why it was held in Qatar. You know, we all know the reason. You know, if they could put it on a space shuttle, they'd put it there. They know perfectly well that it's a very fragile system. There's a huge popular movement opposing all of these investor rights agreements and whatever they're doing, and it can easily erode. I mean, the business press goes berserk when something collapses. So, for example, when the popular opposition forced the OECD to fail to sign the multilateral agreement on investment, this was April 1998. You take a look at the business press, the Financial Times of London. You know, they were very upset. You know, big headlines about how hordes of vigilantes have overwhelmed the poor little OECD, the biggest concentration of power in the world. You know, all the rich states, the multinational corporations. Overwhelmed by, you know, Maud Barlow and two or three other activists and the people they represented. And that's true. They had to back off over tremendous popular protest. And they were very upset. I mean, they quote the trade representatives as saying pretty soon it may not be possible to pass trade agreements in secret and have them rubber stamped by Parliament. I mean, it's a catastrophe, you know. And they know how close that is to realization, just as the constraints on use of violence are very, you know, very fragile, and they know it. I mean, just to give you a last example. When any administration comes into office, the first thing they do is have a big intelligence review. Joint intelligence services give a kind of review of the world situation. And that was done when Bush number one came into office. And evidently somebody in the Pentagon or State Department or somewhere was unhappy about it and leaked a piece of it. Which was kind of hidden away in the bottom of a gossip column by Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, but it was there. It was a passage that said it dealt with what to do in international confrontations. And here's what it said. It said, in the case of confrontations with a much weaker enemy, meaning any imaginable enemy, in the case of confrontation with a much weaker enemy, we must win decisively and rapidly, because under any other conditions, popular support will erode. Okay, that wasn't true 40 years ago. Now, if you take a look at the wars of the 1990s, that's what they are. You have to fight totally defenseless enemies from a great distance, and you have to win rapidly and decisively, or else you're in deep trouble. That was not true in the early 1960s. They could go on for years, and nobody cared. Well, okay, that's the way constraints are imposed. Plenty of other examples.
I'm a Palestinian refugee, and I've just escaped the U.S. foreign policies conducted by its climate regime, Israel. And
you better keep your face hidden,
yeah.
Given or John Ashcroft may notice.
Anyway, I thought that I come to the States, I'll be safe, right? I've escaped the U.S. foreign policies. Yet I find that there is a great convergence between different elements from the right and the left, along with the media, on attacking the Arabs right now by changing the law for what's going to be in the future, pretext, a lawful pretext to attack any form of opposition. Just your opinion on how does that violate human rights?
Well, first of all, there's absolutely nothing, yeah, it obviously violates human rights, there's no need to comment, but the only comment I'll make is that there's absolutely nothing new about it. That's been going on for as long as you want to trace it back. What were the British and the French doing in the Middle East? you know, handing out candy to babies? No. I mean, like using poison gas, aerial bombardment, all kinds of atrocities. And the U.S. simply took over from them and has been doing the same thing for the last 50 years. In that respect, nothing fundamental has changed. Modalities have changed. I mean, tactics have changed. So the concerns, but the basic principles remain the same. After all, why is the United States? Just take a look at the U.S. relation to Israel. What solidified that relation? Well, you know, you're a Palestinian. You should know. Up until 1967, it was not a particularly close relationship. In fact, support for Israel was very weak in the United States, including those who are the most passionate supporters today. 1967 changed all that, and it established the relationship. And the reason was that in 1967, Israel performed a real service. It destroyed independent, secular, Palestinian Arab nationalism, namely Nasser. You know. And that was a real service. Destroying secular nationalism is a major service. Actually, it's had effects, like leading to the rise of religious fundamentalism all over the place. It's one of the things that happens when you destroy secular nationalism. But it was important. Nasser at the time, Nasserite, this has nothing to do with whether Nasser was a nice guy or not. He wasn't a horrible guy, but he was representing independent nationalism and non-alignment, and that's unacceptable. Israel destroyed it. He was, in fact, threatening Saudi Arabia at the time, the real centerpiece of U.S. interests, because that's where the oil is, threatening it in the sense that those ideas might have led to a revolution in Saudi Arabia. That was all finished after 67. Okay, that's when the relationship solidified, and Israel became a partner in the system that includes Turkey and Iran under the Shah, and Pakistan for a while, and trying to control Arab nationalism. Now it's a leading partner. You know, these are just new tactical modifications of traditional policies, actually taken right over from the British.
Professor Chomsky, I have one question for you. Do you think that in the growing coming weeks, if bombs do fall on Iraq as it appears that they're going to, do you think that there's going to be more of a stifling of dissent in the United States by the mainstream media, or the media entirely in general?
Well, you know, that's again a matter of choice. You don't have to agree to be stifled. There isn't a lot that they can do to people like us. I mean, if you happen to be an immigrant, there's a lot they can do. You know, if you are a poor kid living in the ghetto, there's a lot they can do. But, I mean, I don't know you, but I guess you're like the rest of us. We're pretty privileged people, meaning very protected. So, yes, you don't have to accept stifling of dissent. Sure, there would be an effort. I mean, every time there's a use of violence, there's an effort to stifle dissent for perfectly obvious reasons. In the case of Iraq, it's kind of worth bearing in mind something that I haven't seen mentioned in the press. Every month for the last 10 years, the death toll among children is approximately the same as the number of people killed on September 11th. That's every month, you know, without extensive bombing. I'm not convinced that they're going to go on to bomb, because I think that the costs elsewhere in the region might be considered too high to accept. But if they do, yeah, there'll be an effort which we should resist, just like we should resist the attempt to extend the bombing.
Can I just say that I wish we could go on forever, but we have some firm requests that we have
okay.
to...
Okay, one last.
Professor Chomsky.
Move forward.
Yeah, Professor Chomsky, these days there's a lot of talk about an agenda of human rights that I guess foreign powers want to impose in Afghanistan. I wonder if you could comment on this agenda.
Well, I'm all in favor of human rights in Afghanistan, like everywhere else. But they have to be imposed. But here, I think we ought to follow the lead of the Afghans. And you know, they are not as silent as you might guess from reading the press. So, for example, recently in the last couple of weeks, there's a lot of concern, even Laura Bush, about the rights of women in Afghanistan. Okay, that's correct. It's a serious problem. Actually, I should say that the rights of women in Afghanistan, which are horrendous, are not very different from much of the rest of Central and South Asia. Not very different. Take a look at the careful analyses of you know, say parts of India, it's kind of like under the Taliban, and it's not the only place. So yeah, it's correct to be concerned about that. There is an organization that is concerned about it, and has been for a long time, RAWA, the Revolutionary Association for the Women of Afghanistan, which has been fighting this battle for 25 years, and it hasn't been an easy one. Their leader was assassinated by an Afghan who was kind of like a KGB agent. They've been fighting under very harsh conditions, and they've had things to say about how this should be handled. They have bitterly condemned the bombardment and have said that the struggle against oppression and violation of women's rights and other rights in Afghanistan should be fought by the Afghan people without their country being destroyed by outsiders who are interested only in killing them, you know. Well, you know, that ought to be a front page headline. If it isn't, we ought to make it that. They're the Afghan people, the defenders of women's rights, not since yesterday, like Laura Bush, but for 25 years, and fighting hard, you know, real struggles. So, like you could argue, maybe they don't know as much about Afghanistan as people who couldn't have placed it on a map 2 months ago. Maybe, but it's not obvious. And they're not the only ones, by any means. So yeah, we should be concerned about human rights in Afghanistan, and it's a problem. The Afghans should play the lead in that. And they've been pretty outspoken.
That was Professor Noam Chomsky speaking last month at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for that tape. Next, Christian Parenti on crime laws and prisons as a means of social control. This talk was part of a forum on the prison industrial complex that took place last fall at SUNY Cortland, sponsored by the Ithaca Coalition for Global Justice.
Christian Parenti is the author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis. This book documents the horrors and absurdities of militarized policing, prisons, a fortified border, and the federalization of the war on crime. Quote, "The central moral and political struggle of the new century will be the ever-expanding police state," writes Van Jones, National Executive Director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. "I predict that the book will do for the movement against the prison industrial complex what Rachel Carson's Silent Spring did for the movement against environmental devastation." Parenti has penned a manifesto, end quote. He teaches at the New College of California in San Francisco, and his writings appear in The Nation, The Progressive, In These Times, Salon, and the Christian Science Monitor. So please, on this chilly day out here, let's give a warm welcome to Christian Parenti.
What I'm going to talk about briefly is to try and answer the question why the U.S., with 4% of the world's population, has 25% of the world's prisoners. And it's not so easy to answer that. The standard explanation that we come up with on the left, I think, often relies on a very immediate, direct link between the profit motive and repression. So we have all these prisons because we have private prisons. So we have all these prisons because of prison labor. But in fact, while private prisons are highly problematic, while prison labor is highly problematic, and we need to problematize and attack those things whenever we can, I don't think that that's explanation enough. That actually prison labor, the boom begins before prison labor is re-legalized. It begins before private prisons are enacted or are legalized. Private prisons, despite their stock bounce since September 11th, are still in crisis. Most prisons are not privatized, and the interesting question is, well, why are prisons not profitable? But that's a whole other discussion. So why then this boom? Where does it come from? Well, to answer that question, you have to go back to when it begins, and it begins in the late 1960s. And what's happening in the late 1960s is the American system is facing a dual crisis, a political crisis of rebellion and an economic crisis. And these two phenomena are separate but then intertwined as well. So we'll deal first with the political crisis, then the economic crisis, and all the while thinking about prisons. What's the political crisis? Obviously, the crisis of the rebellion of the 60s that you're all familiar with to some extent, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, the anti-war movement, the less well-known poor people's and welfare rights movement that was very radical, caused lots of problems for the state, and most of all, the riots of the 1960s, beginning in 1964 in Harlem, then really kicking off in 65 in Watts, and then every summer after that, major riots in every major city, some cities like Newark being hit twice by huge riots, where you have black, in Newark, you have that, you know, the absolute worst nightmare of the city fathers. You have African American and white, working class white immigrants from Appalachia sniping at the cops and the National Guard. So this is the specter of social collapse emerging before the eyes of the U.S. government and the U.S. elites who control the major financial institutions and corporations and think tanks in the society. What is the police response to this crisis? Well, we usually think that, well, in the 60s, you know, the police cracked heads and eventually they won the 1960s and the Black Panthers ended up in jail and the cops won. And that's true to some extent. But there was a moment there, a rather long moment for some people, when it didn't look like that at all. In fact, it looked quite the opposite. You had a situation where the police were in fact exacerbating the crisis of the 60s by applying either too little repression or too much repression. I say that in a purely technical, amoral sense. An example of how the police were making things worse by applying too little repression would be how the young Daryl Gates handled the riots in Watts in 65. He was in command of coordinating a force of the LAPD, the Sheriff's Department, and the Highway Patrol, all of whom hated each other, didn't cooperate, didn't share radio frequencies, and they had this uprising in Watts. First there was confusion, then there was total chaos, then paralysis, then they withdrew, and there was this huge riot. The riot was problematic for a number of reasons. One, there was a lot of property loss, and the interest in LA that lost that property or were connected to the value of real estate direct, you know, in general, didn't like that. But also politically, internationally, the riots in Watts were a major problem for the U.S. You have to remember, the U.S. is ramping up its war in Vietnam. It's fighting all sorts of other economic systems, directly and indirectly. It's struggling against national liberation movements that are socialist, such as the National Liberation Front in Vietnam. It's also struggling against sort of mixed economies and third world nationalism, sort of a la the Nasserite model in Egypt. And all the while, the U.S. is trying to argue that the system that delivers the goods is liberal democracy and free market capitalism. And so when you have African-American people exploding in the streets, burning down stores, and then the international press corps runs to them and says, what do you want? Meaning, why are you doing this? They say to these young men writing, what do you want? And they say, more ammunition. That's what we want. Meaning, our problems are so profound that, you know, you can't even begin to understand what the issues are here. So this is a black eye to the U.S. and its system internationally. So it has to be controlled because it's connected to all these other projects. An example of how the police made things worse by applying too much repression would be the Democratic Convention of 1968. There they wade in, crack heads, they're beating up Episcopalian grandmothers as they're putting them in the paddy wagons, and all this, again, is on international news. And the effect is not to silence the movement, scare activists away. In fact, it emboldens the movement. People become more radical, more people get out on the street. And there's a crisis in the Democratic Party. The conference splits down the middle. You have mainstream Democrats saying, hey, we got to call this off because the police in this town are completely out of control. You have Richard Daley, as a result, yelling anti-Semitic things at another congressman. And again, internationally, the U.S. looks horrible. And it puts the lie to the idea of democracy and racial harmony and progress in the U.S. So in response to this police crisis, and in response to the crisis of rebellion, the federal government finally steps in 1967. Lyndon Johnson gets his young attorney general to draft legislation that passes the House in 1968. And this becomes the Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act of 1968, the first big federal crime bill, the type of which we're so familiar with now. Interestingly, this bill passes the House as D.C. is literally going up in flames for a second time. Martin Luther King has just been killed. Dr. King's just been killed. And there are riots in the northeast of the city, and there's smoke billowing over the Capitol, concentrating the minds of the legislators. And they pass this bill, which creates the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, a huge federal bureaucracy that over the next 10 years distributes about $1 billion a year from the federal government to local law enforcement to try and retool and re-educate the police to get them to deal with the crisis of rebellion. So that's when modern policing as we know it really begins. That's when you get the proliferation of helicopters, the proliferation of canine units, the proliferation of body armor. That's when shoulder radios are introduced, car radios. They didn't have car radios in many places before that. That's when SWAT teams are developed. You had SWAT teams in the mid-60s before that, but that's when all major cities get paramilitarily trained police armed with semi-automatic weapons. That's when the National Crime and Information Center, the central computerized database controlled by the FBI, that's when that's developed, and all local law enforcement feeds into that and can draw information from that. All states have to set up law enforcement planning administrations to force coordination between their myriad law enforcement agencies. That's also when police officers for the first time have to learn how to read, because a lot of them didn't have to know how to read. In fact, most beauticians had to have more training than cops in the early 60s. This is the first part of the buildup. And there isn't, concomitant with this, a massive increase in the rate of incarceration, but there is a massive increase in the importance of law enforcement to American politics. And with this bureaucratic change comes also a change in rhetoric. And that begins amidst the crisis of the early 60s. You have Barry Goldwater linking welfare, crime, and communism, and therefore sort of running against communists, black people, and poor people all at the same time, because in his racist worldview, of course, everyone on welfare is black, even though actually, you know, obviously, as you guys probably remember from welfare reform, the average person on welfare was a 7-year-old white child. And crime, of course, only is committed by black people in the minds of Barry Goldwater. So you get this merging of this new kind of rhetoric, which at the time was new. People were wondering, why is this presidential candidate running against crime? Because crime is handled by local authorities. It's not handled by the federal government. But it worked very well for Goldwater. Nixon takes it up, and you get this increased demonization of people of color through the discourse of crime. So racism is reincarnated as the anti-crime public safety discourse. This wave of repression plateaus in the late 70s, in part because of Watergate, in part because of the Church Committee hearings, in part because activists broke into the FBI offices in Media, Pennsylvania, and stole the COINTELPRO documents, which proved that the FBI had, since the 50s, been targeting first the Communist Party and then African-American organizations for elimination and liquidation. So all of this finally starts turning the average mainstream American off to the idea of giving more and more money and more power to the police and the federal government. And so there's this plateau, sort of moment of detente under Ford and Carter. The criminal justice buildup picks up again in the early 80s. But to understand that second wave in the takeoff, we have to get back to the economic crisis. Simultaneously with this political crisis, there's an economic crisis. What is that? Well, basically, at the end of World War II, the U.S. emerges as the world's number one industrial power. The war, along with killing millions of people, has destroyed billions of dollars worth of stuff, which is actually a very good thing for capitalism. Because then you have to rebuild it, and that creates economic activity and profitability. And you have the golden era of American capitalism, which is essentially the moment in which Japan and Europe are rebuilding, and the U.S. is in the position of reaping the lion's share of the benefits of that. So in 1946, the U.S. produces fully half of all world output. The recovery in these two other poles of world capitalism requires American consumer goods, American capital, and the profits are immense. And they'd never been higher, and they've never been higher since then. So in this context, it's possible for corporate America to start paying higher wages, to make peace with unions by buying off unions, that is through higher wages, to submit to higher taxation, et cetera, and still have very high profit rates. Profit rates peak in 1964 at an after-tax profit rate of about 10%, and they'd never been higher than that. They then start declining precipitously until the early 70s. And just a footnote here, why is this important, the profit rate? Because that's what the system is all about, right? I mean, that's what capitalism is all about. Nothing gets done if there isn't a profit made by investors, and that is the central organizing principle of this society. So throughout the late 60s into the early 70s, profit rates are declining very, very precipitously, and this is not good. The reason for this is primarily an international overproduction of goods. Too much of a good thing creates crisis for capitalism. I mean, this is why there's a boom and bust cycle in capitalism, what you call the business cycle when it takes a mild form, or boom and bust, you know, tendency towards depression. Because when things go well and there's lots of growth, eventually there's too much stuff and not enough consumers, and then economic activity constricts in response to declining profitability, and you get depressions and recessions. So you have, by the mid-60s, Japan and Europe recovering, supplying their own markets. Many countries in the global south, newly industrialized countries like South Korea, start also producing for their own markets and increasingly supplying the U.S. market, so that you have, by the mid-60s, everyone who is going to buy a washing machine or buy an automobile pretty much has one. And there's a glut and a crisis. The other local reason for the crisis was that labor, organized and unorganized, which is the source of all wealth, nature and labor produce all wealth, which is then a portion of it is expropriated by the owners of private property, and that's profit. Labor has grown too strong thanks to the New Deal, the struggles of the New Deal, the progressive legislation passed during that time that recognizes the power of labor, and then also the war on poverty, which we often think of, the war on poverty in the 60s, we think of that as being about, you know, the poor. But it also was about the general working class, and it emboldened the working class as a whole. So you have, during this economic decline in the late 60s, early 70s, the unusual situation of rising unemployment and rising wages. And this had never happened before. Economists call this inverse relationship between these two dynamics, the Phillips curve. When unemployment goes up, workers get scared, wages go down. But for the first time in American history, you have unemployment going up and labor not responding. People not working harder for less. In fact, quits, the ratio between quits and layoffs increases. More people are quitting their jobs than being laid off, which is a measurement of labor's indirect power. More directly, organized labor is also launching lots and lots of strikes. There's a whole hidden history of labor radicalism in the late 60s, early 70s, into the mid-70s. The mid-70s are just a time of total chaos for employers. Wildcat strikes in the coal fields, nationwide trucking being shut down several times, postal service being shut down. Nixon calls out the National Guard and the Air Force to move the mails, and half of them don't even show up. So labor is not responding to the crisis. And there's no better illustration of how the war on poverty was empowering labor than this example. That in 1968, General Electric, which was the fourth largest employer in the country at that time, and a very anti-union firm, faced off against 12 unions in a big strike and lost. And the board of directors of GE got together and wanted to figure out, well, what was going on. They did a study and they found that thanks to recent progressive changes in the law, the strikers were not only getting the strike funds from their unions, but they were collecting welfare. So from the point of view of the owners and the board of directors of General Electric, this whole welfare system, which is about sort of maintaining inequality, keeping the lid on things, is actually state-subsidized class warfare. From their point of view, they get taxed. The government then gives it to workers who go on strike to demand more wages. And you begin to get a shift in elite thinking away from Keynesianism and welfare politics towards a more old-fashioned neoliberal repressive model. This finally comes to fruition at the end of the Carter era, when Carter appoints Paul Volcker as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Volcker and all through the 70s, there's profit rates and growth don't recover. There's just this general malaise. Volcker's solution is to create the second worst recession, or the worst recession since the Great Depression. He does this by jacking interest rates up to 16%. So this just freezes the flow of money into the economy, becomes harder to borrow money to start a business or to go to school or to hire new workers. Economic activity constricts intensely. And at the same time, Reagan comes into office after Volcker is appointed, and the recession is continuing until 82, and he immediately goes after organized labor and fires the air traffic controllers, stacks the National Labor Relations Board with conservatives who rule against labor, and the net effect of the recession and the policy offensive against labor, and then also begins to cut welfare, the indirect support for working people, the net effect is to rediscipline the American working class. So by 1984, well, in 1980, not a single union contract involved a wage freeze or a wage give back, and none of them had since 1961. By 1984, 44% of all union contracts involved wage freezes or outright wage give backs. You have also massive tax cuts for the rich, which means less money to municipalities to build public housing, to maintain roads, to fund schools. You have massive deindustrialization as American capital goes overseas in search of cheaper labor, which further erodes local tax bases. And you have, by the early 80s, the return of very serious poverty. Not that poverty had ever gone away, but the general standard of living had been going up and up into the mid-70s. And so you have by the early 80s, Detroit and Philadelphia having official poverty rates of 33%. And the poverty rate itself is then lowered. That number is lowered under Reagan. So this major crisis, which helps to restore profitability, all these changes. Business having to pay less taxes, business getting to hire workers for less, getting to avoid unions, it does help to restore profitability. But it creates this political problem. How do you manage the poor? Because the fundamental issue here is the fact that capitalism both needs poverty and is threatened by poverty. It both creates poverty organically through the boom and bust cycle and creates it artificially through policies like welfare reform. But the poor can't just be ignored for a number of reasons. One, the poor have historically always rebelled, though we're not taught this in school. Two, they undermine the legitimacy of the system. It's hard to say that a society is just and fair when there are many, many people who are very, very poor. And third, the poor threaten the money classes in indirect and sort of apolitical ways. They show up in the wrong place at the wrong time outside ritzy hotels begging, and that scares people and can undermine business operations. So there has to be a methodology for controlling the poor. That methodology, increasingly from the New Deal through the war on poverty, had been to co-opt and ameliorate through job training, through welfare, et cetera, et cetera. That could no longer be done because of the whole crisis I explained. So what's the technique? Well, you get this re-engagement with the war on drugs and the whole build-up from the 70s, beginning at first very slowly in 82, then more aggressively in 84 with the sort of the first big federal crime bill of the Reagan era, which creates the assets forfeiture laws, which was designed specifically to recruit local municipalities into the war on drugs because they weren't necessarily interested in expending lots of money to go down and hunt down drug dealers. And so there's this they're dealt in by being allowed to take the assets that they seize. In 96, you have another major crime bill. That's when crack hits the streets officially, and there's this moral panic around crack cocaine, and you get 29 new mandatory minimums, new grants for local law enforcement. 88, another major crime bill. This is an election year, presidential election year. You have the Willie Horton ads out there, which George Bush creates an ad around the case of Willie Horton, who is an escaped prisoner who happened to be African American. He escaped from prison in Massachusetts. Bush is running against Michael Dukakis in Massachusetts, clobbers Dukakis. And that affects the whole policy climate of that year. And there's, you know, more money, more new mandatory minimums. Again in 1990, more money, more federal mandatory minimums, $9 billion in federal grants to local law enforcement by that point. Bush leaves office. Clinton comes in. There's the L.A. riots. Clinton promises 100 new cops. There's sort of a year of gestation or so. And then 94. Biggest crime bill yet, $30 billion from the federal government to local law enforcement, a slew of new laws, changing the rules around prosecution, eroding the rules around the exclusion of evidence, all of which is boosting incarceration rates. 96, you get the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, more of the same. 96, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which basically guts prisoners' ability to use the law to struggle for their civil rights in prison, and so on and so forth, until you get basically to the present, where we have 2 million people in prison. And essentially what this is about is managing the new political economy of the U.S., which has been massively restructured. You seem like a pretty young audience, so I'll assume that you maybe don't remember the 70s and the 80s that well. But the political economy of this country is very, very different from what it was 20 or 30 years ago. And it has to be managed, and so it's managed through these methodologies of demonization, which is to say racist demonization of the poor, segregation, and naked state repression. Now, that all began to plateau finally about last year, and it seemed like maybe this buildup was stopping. And I don't know what's happening, what's going to happen, but I think with 9/11 and the passage of the Uniting and Strengthening America Act, which is the Anti-Terrorism Act, that we could see another increase in the rate of incarceration, because rates of incarceration had begun to plateau in many states. The federal system was still increasing, but it looked like there was a change beginning. So just briefly, certain things about this law that you should be aware of. It loosens the rules around wiretapping. It allows for interagency information sharing, so the CIA can share information with the FBI, who can share with the local police. There's all sorts of warrantless searches that are now possible for searching not the content of your emails, but the pattern of your internet use, who you're emailing, not necessarily what you're emailing to them. There's new sneak and peek warrants, where the federal authorities have the right to search your office or abode and not tell you for 90 days. And roving wiretaps, which mean that authorities can get a tap for not just a phone line, but for a person, which means they can then tap all the potential telecommunications that that person uses. So if one were to tap Larry as opposed to Larry's phone, you could possibly tap all of the computers in the philosophy department and all of the computers and telephones of people that he's in regular contact with. Anyway, so we have now yet another escalation in the legal technology of repression in this country. And just to end on a positive note, the one thing I would say that we should not lose hope in is that, you know, they've always had the laws of a police state on the books. The president has always had the right to suspend the Constitution and all that. But why don't they do that? They don't do that because they can't do it. Because the law, the life of the law, is not simply the letter of the law. The life of the law is determined by the balance of power between the state and the people. And there are numerous examples of how the state, even in this day and age of lock them up and throw away the key, is restrained from using the powers it already has. For example, secret evidence. Immigrants, since 1996, it is legal to detain immigrants on secret evidence which the immigrant cannot see and deport them. Yet they hardly ever use this. They use it a handful of times every year. And the reason they don't use it more often is because every time they do use it, organizations like the National Lawyers Guild and the ACLU and activists like yourself hit them really hard and fight tooth and nail in every case. And it's just not possible to do that. And mainstream public opinion has not yet gotten to the point where people feel okay with mass immigration roundups. So we can take some solace in that fact that regardless of what laws they have on the books, it's only the larger political climate that we all help create that will permit them to use those laws or will prevent them from using them.
That was Christian Parenti, author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis, speaking late last year in Cortland.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We we are solely responsible for its content.
Just like the Bible and the prophets suggest.